Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below.
Right, and with that, please let me introduce Rafe Kelly, who is not just somebody who looks like an ancient Greek god, but he's also moving like this. So Rafe is the founder of Evolve Move Play. His background is in all kind of movements. He studied, I'm just looking at your website, studied Tang So Do, Aikido, Kung Fu, Kickboxing, BJJ, Capoeira, Muay Thai, Sistema, also gymnastics, weightlifting. And out of all of that, Rafe became interested in natural movement training and the research of this, and developed Evolve Move Play out of that. The session today is called Movement and Meaning Crisis, how mindful movement practices provide the foundation for a more meaningful life. Rafe, the stage is all yours. It's so great to have you.
Excellent, thank you. So I'll go ahead and share my screen. Oop, you have to allow me to share my screen.
I will do that. All right.
And is it? Okay, is everybody seeing this? Looks good. Okay, so this is about Evolve Move Play. So the one thing that didn't get mentioned was actually parkour, which I've done for 15 years and it's kind of my deepest background, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So this is about Evolve Move Play. If you want to check out our awesome offers, we got that at the down there. But let's get started. So we find ourselves with a strange paradox living in the modern world. No generation has had the privileges that we have. There's wider spread of affluence than ever in history. More people live above the poverty line than we can historically find. We have abundant food, we have clean water, we have shelter, we have physical safety. You're less likely to die of illness, be assaulted, have a bad accident than at any time in history. And yet, despite all that privilege that we experience, there's a sense that something is wrong. And in fact, there are many things wrong. We have a set of growing crises that we need to address. So we have epidemics of ill health, right? Obesity is epidemic throughout the Western world and is growing everywhere in the world. And it's not just obesity, there's all of these diseases of metabolic ill health like diabetes. And beyond that, I think we have an epidemic of physical weakness and poor coordination. People are simply not experiencing their bodies and embodied, as we talk about at this conference. And that's having an impact not only in the body itself, but also psychologically. And we see this with epidemic rates of depression, anxiety, and now suicide. And in the United States, 1 in 6 people is on psychiatric medication. For women, that's 1 in 4. And many of those drugs are in the classes of amphetamines, opioids, and benzodiazepines, which are all extremely profound drugs of abuse. And whether you take them with a prescription or without a prescription, they're extremely dangerous to you. So my friend and teacher, John Verbeke, who also spoke at this conference, describes all of this as part of a single overarching crisis, a meta crisis, if you will, that he calls the meaning crisis. And he connects these also to the environmental crisis that we face, the political crisis that is very salient right now for those of us in the United States and everybody watching around the world, and, you know, upcoming potential economic crises that have been very much accelerated by COVID-19. So what should we do about this? And my answer might be a relatively strange one, but I actually believe that the most foundational place that we can start is in movement practice. That movement practice cultivates the types of selves that we need to be able to take on the systematic problems that we need, that we face. John Vervaeke, who I mentioned, said at our July movement conference that what we need to overcome the meaning crisis is mindful movement practices. And that's what I agree with. So here we go. We need sustained wisdom traditions of mindful movement in order to optimize our chance of recovering meaning in life. And when we have greater meaning, when we have greater connection to what matters most, which, you know, what I'm advocating for in movement practice isn't just move. It's move in a way that taps into mindfulness, that taps into embodiment, that taps into connection to nature, and that taps into community. And it's within those connections that we can build those selves. So in order to give you guys a frame for the meaning crisis, we're going to talk a little bit about some pop culture and a little bit of my personal history. So most of you guys have probably seen this movie, Fight Club. If you haven't, you're probably familiar with the movie and its premise. It's a movie about a disaffected corporate drone and his encounter with a charismatic rebel, Tyler Durden. And in that movie, they form a fight club, and then that fight club develops into a revolutionary project, Project Mayhem, a project that ultimately the narrator does not support. I think this is a movie about the meaning crisis. And for me, this line here from Tyler Durden is the critical line. After the narrator's condo blows up, he sits down with Tyler in a bar and he talks about how he's lost all the meaningful things in his life and everything he's describing as something that he owns. And Tyler says to him, you know, throw that all away. Don't worry about that. We work jobs that we hate to buy things that we don't need to impress people we don't like. And I think this is as emblematic a description of the meaning crisis as has ever come out of pop culture, right? This is the disaffectation that we're all feeling at the moment. Sorry, my notes have just arrived. When I discovered parkour, let me back up a second. When I saw that movie, I was 19 years old, and I could see that there was something destructive about it, Project Mayhem, and that it wasn't the right path. But ultimately, I was more convinced by Tyler Durden than anything that I was seeing and the culture around me. I wanted to be in Fight Club. In fact, I started a boxing club at university. But when I discovered parkour 4 years later, it was as if I had found a positive answer to the question that Tyler Durden is proposing. Right? And when we look at parkour, we see that, in fact, in many ways, it parallels Fight Club. Right? In Fight Club, you have these two characters who find that through physical challenge, through confronting the mortality, and through developing it in within community, they find something very deeply meaningful in life. And that's precisely what the young men who started parkour are. Here you see the Yamakaze, David Bell, and Sebastian Foucault. So Sebastian spoke earlier at this conference, as well as Laurent, who's pictured a couple times in here. And these guys basically were kids from poor immigrant backgrounds that were raised in the slums, the banlieues of Paris, and they were disaffected. They were alienated by their culture. And they found that through pursuing physical challenge, through testing themselves, and through doing it as part of community, that they could overcome themselves in a way that gave them a deep sense of meaning. So these guys, they jumped around, they did all these beautiful things, and their movement became something that was attractive to people around the world, myself included. But there was an underlying philosophy to that movement, something that was, in fact, very different from what we saw within Fight Club, because Fight Club ultimately is nihilistic. Ultimately, it is destructive, right? There's a moment where Tyler Durden and the narrator are in a bus and they see a Calvin Klein model in an ad. And they say self-development is masturbation, self-destruction. And they kind of stop there. But that the implication is that's where the real juice is. But parkour, despite the fact that it has this real commonality, went in the opposite direction, right? it starts with a very pro-social ethic. Most parkour athletes have adopted this idea of être fort pour être utile, which is an older method, this motto from France, and it means be strong to be useful. And the Yamakazi is a Lingala word, a West African word that means strong man, strong mind, strong spirit. And they talked about the practice as building an ethical person, someone who's honest, someone who's hardworking, someone who's courageous. And this is fundamentally what I think we're doing. So when I first encountered parkour, I'll go back for a second, we'll come to Jordan Peterson in a second here. When I first encountered parkour, I was completely falling in love with it. And it was really, really profound for me. And I was in this very play-like space. But then over time, the meaning didn't quite continue for me. It didn't continue to work. And the thing is that these guys who started parkour, they had an underlying philosophy, but it was sort of incomplete. It wasn't well articulated because they were young men and they were mostly not highly educated. And they were French speakers who didn't speak English. And so as it spread throughout the world, we all got a kind of low resolution copy of it. And so the movement spread, but the philosophy didn't. And when I encountered Jordan Peterson, that was when I felt like I found an articulation of the underlying profound philosophy that I had been experiencing through my practice of parkour. And this is the pursuit of the heroic self. I had gone from a very play-like approach to parkour, which was useful for me for a time, to being very professional in my orientation to parkour and trying to perform like an elite professional athlete. And that had actually resulted in a ton of burnout and breakdown and injury, and it was not working for me. So then I went back to play, and that was working for me for a while, but wasn't deriving what I was looking for. But through the stories and the narratives I was sharing with my students, I was discovering something deeper, something about the way that we transform over time. And when I discovered Jordan Peterson, he had this articulation that fundamentally what we should be aimed at is meaning in life. This should be the point of our practice. And I discovered this was really aligned with what I had been experiencing in parkour and what I had heard the founders of parkour talk about, but it had never been precisely described in this way. So what I discovered as I started reading more deeply along these lines, and I started looking to the works of people like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and his work on flow, or Stephen Kotler, who also spoke on this and his work on flow, is that this sense of meaning as the optimal goal for a movement practice is not something that's unique to parkour either. That whether we look at Aikido or Jiu-Jitsu or yoga, the people who sustain their practices for long periods of time do so because they have a sense that it connects them to something that's deeply meaningful in the moment that they're doing it, or it's transforming them in a profound way over time. So when you ask people, why do you do it? They talk about loss of self-consciousness while they're doing it. They talk about being in the zone. They talk about, you know, it just being extremely rewarding. And all of these are associated with the flow state. And the flow state we know is strongly associated with the sense of meaning in life. Right? People also find that through their movement practice, they're able to create deeper community and intimacy. There's something really intimate about having done a really hard challenge with somebody, a really big struggle with somebody, having sparred with somebody. And we crave and need that. And many movement practices also give us access to nature, which is incredibly important, or self-expression. And ultimately, what you'll hear many people describe using the same words in many different arts is that their character changes over time in positive ways because of the movement practices that they engage with. Ultimately, I came to believe that the purpose of movement practice should be about meaning. And let me go back for a second here. There's three frames that I think that we're looking at movement through right now that are not really serving us. The first is the health frame. We all know that we should exercise because our health will suffer if we don't. We've had dozens of years of marketing around this, of public health campaigns, and yet most people simply still choose not to do it, right? We know that in order to avoid ill health, we need to exercise, and that doesn't seem to motivate us. And then the second one is aesthetics, right? We are bombarded with images of beautiful young people with fit bodies who we're trying to aspire to be like, or told to aspire to be like. And yet again, most people don't do it. And this one's worse because it's also causing all sorts of psychological issues. We see a rise in anorexia. We see a rise of performance enhancing drug use, even in teenagers. So that's not serving us. And then the final one that does work for some people some of the time is competition. But ultimately that tends to fail too. I spoke with Danny Wei as part of this conference, and you know, here's a guy who's won the X Games 5 times, but ultimately he's not motivated by winning competitions. He's motivated by the transformation that he experiences when he's on his board and what's happening when he's on his board. So there has to be something more. And ultimately I think the right orientation is meaning, but what does meaning mean, right? One of the lessons that I derived from Peterson's work that was really meaningful to me was this simple question that, or observation that if you choose to practice something, you're placing it within a value system. You're saying this thing that I am practicing is more valuable than something else I could be doing. And you may be realizing that explicitly, or it may just be implicit, but there has to be a value system that guides where you're going. And the greater our clarity in doing that, the better we can actually get the benefit that we're seeking, right? If we understand the why of our practice, we can actually get there a lot better. So many people think the why of their practice is competition, and they burn themselves out and break themselves down and find that winning at the end of the day wasn't actually what was motivating them, right? Or they think that it's because they want to look beautiful and they go maybe be on a bodybuilding stage and find that's not actually what's motivating to them. So we have to articulate this better. One really simple one that we see is a very powerful motivational system is fun. If you ask most people who have started parkour why they do it, they'll tell you just because it's fun, right? It's fun to move, and it is fun, and fun is great, and play is a powerful and important motivational system. But there's a problem with that as the end all of your value system, right? Just doing it because it's fun ultimately is a form of hedonism, right? And parkour can be really fun. Movement practice of any kind can be really fun. And also eating lots of junk food can be fun in the moment, right? Playing lots of video games can be fun in the moment. Having hedonistic sexual experiences can be fun in the moment, but they ultimately don't give us satisfaction over the long term. The difference between meaning and happiness or fun, as Jordan Peterson said, is that meaning sustains you even when you're not happy, even when you're not having fun. And the truth is that people who devote a lot of their life and derive a ton of meaning from a movement practice aren't having fun all the time. There's always a necessity for discipline. There's always a necessity for hard work. So we need something more. So there's these two aspects to what we need. One is we have to be connecting to the things that simply give us meaning. Flow state is meaningful the moment that you're in it. Connection to community is meaningful. Connection to nature is meaningful. Having a better and deeper relationship with your body is meaningful. But then the other aspect is how we transform over time. So I want to bring up this idea that Eric Fromm, the psychoanalyst, had, which is that we have a modal confusion between our having needs and our being needs. We've tended to believe that if we can have enough of the right things, that will make us happy. But happiness is something we experience in being. It's not something that you can purchase. It's not something that you can simply consume. So I want to have a hamburger. I want to have a chocolate cake, right? I want to have sex with that beautiful person. Those are sensual desires that once satisfied actually don't have long-term changes to your well-being. So if you have a piece of chocolate cake right now, you may experience an intense rush of pleasure, but a week from now, that chocolate cake won't mean anything to you. So what we find is that being a stronger person, being more educated, being kinder, being better able to connect to people, being more deeply understanding of nature, those are the things that actually give us prolonged, meaningful well-being. So we need to get out of this sense of being stuck in that. So why movement practice? Well, actually, I not only believe that movement practice should be about meaning, I also believe that movement practice is in fact the most powerful foundation we can use to build a more meaningful life. I'm not gonna say it's the only path to the mountaintop, but it is the widest. And it's also strangely the most neglected in our culture. We tend to think of the self as regarding in the brain, as residing in the brain. We have this mind-body duality in our culture, but this is a very specifically a Western idea and really comes out of the conflict between science and religion that started with the discovery of Aristotelian science in the Middle Ages. What we know now from cognitive and neurological science is that the brain itself is built to control movement. That's its first function. And cognition is bootstrapped on top of motor control. The way that we model the world is actually based on motor actions, right? Alfred North Whitehead said once, "We think that our thoughts may die and we don't have to." And this is a really beautiful way to understand what's going on. In movement practice alone, really, all of our systems are integrated in self-cultivation, especially if we understand that it's bringing these things together. The physical, psychological, and emotional all come together in movement practice. And in fact, I don't think we can even understand meaning and what meaning in life actually means without understanding movement. And this is one of the key discoveries of cognitive science. I'm gonna jump forward here, we'll go back to that one. So my mentor, John Verbeekje, I mentioned before, is part of what's called the 4E camp of cognitive science, right? Cognition in this model can only function because it's embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended, okay? So if we go back to the cup here for a second, consider a cup, right? A cup to us is an obvious thing, but if you actually try to teach a computer to recognize what is a cup and what is not a cup, you'll find it's incredibly complex. A cup can be ceramic, as we see here. It can be plastic, it can be metal, it can be round in shape, it can be oval in shape, it can be square in shape, it can have a handle or not a handle, it can be any number of colors. So if you try to assign all of the things that a cup can be and all of the things that a cup is not to a computer, it's almost an impossible problem. However, you can teach a computer to recognize a cup by giving a computer an arm that can grasp something and a task of moving liquid around with the cup. It is only within the embodiment that the cup's purpose is revealed. So the meaning of a cup is not objective. It's not a simple reality of the outside world, but nor is it subjective. If you try to use a cheesecloth as a cup, it's not going to work. And no amount of social construction, no amount of belief will make that cup work. Rather, a cup is something that exists in the relationship between a human being and our capacity for grasping and our motivations to have delicious, frothy liquids that we can deliver to ourselves. So the meaning of a cup exists neither in the objective nor in the subjective. Rather, it exists within what Verbeekje calls the transjective, which is a relationship between an agent and the arena that they move within. And I believe that what is true of the meaning of the cup is actually also true of meaning in life. So in Dr. Peterson's book, Maps of Meaning, he lays out this simple distinction that I think is incredibly vital. We can look at the world as a place of objects, a set of objective things, or we can look at it as a forum for actions. Now, science looks at the world as a set of objective things, and we rightly are incredibly respectful of science because science has given us enormous power, right? We are able to talk to each other right now on video calls in a way we couldn't have done 10 years ago because of the magic of science. But science has disembodied us, right? It has created this mind-body duality, and it has made us blind to the world as an embodied and experienced phenomenon. The meaning in life exists somewhere else. And this is the next point that he makes in Maps of Meaning, is that the world as a place of objects is a world that is stripped of meaning. And it is when we look at the world as a form for actions that we're able to see the meaning in life. John Verbeekje says, these are essentially ways of knowing that have been lost to us. We've become blind to them, but they're there where the meaning is. So we need to understand the transjective. We need to understand how meaning in life is afforded by moving in life. There are real relationships that you can have with the environment. And when you expand those relationships, you're literally living a more meaningful life. And that's precisely what happens when you take on a practice like parkour. When I was first starting to do parkour, before I started to do parkour, I would walk by a handrail and it's just an object that you can put your hand on if you can't balance. But once you discover parkour, it becomes a place where you can practice balance, a place where you can practice precision jumps, a place where you can practice vaults, something you can duck under, something you can practice flow on. right? The meaning in the rail has expanded. The meaning in the wall, the meaning in the tree has expanded. And as I have grown in skill, I have seen new meaning in the world. My life is literally more meaningful. And it's not only the relationship between myself and the environment or any other practitioner in the environment that changes. It's also the relationship between the aspects of the self. One of the kind of core ideas that comes from Jung, all the way back to Jung, is this idea that we have these different modes of the self, right? You have your angry personality and you have your loving personality, and they can be very much in conflict with each other. And you want to have them better integrated. You want to have them in communication with each other. And in physical practice, we actually get the chance to confront those aspects of the self. We get to look at, who am I when I am frustrated? Who am I when I'm angry? Who am I when I am fearful? And how do I become better at regulating that over time? How do I become better at bringing forth the aspect of me that is courageous? And if we bring in more of these embodied practices, we can bring forth the aspects of us that are loving, the aspects of us that are giving towards the world. So we need to start to see where the meaning is in life. The idea that we are, you know, that wisdom and insight come only from the mind is a very strange and specifically Western idea of a very recent vintage. When we think of philosophers, we tend to think of people who are the farthest from athletes, who have nothing in the way of physical practices. But this is really a historical and cross-cultural anomaly. We look at Plato, who we see over here. Plato is not his original name. His original name is Aristocles. Plato is rather a nickname, meaning broad, that he earned as a wrestler. And the dialogues of Plato and the birth of philosophy happened in the gymnasia. The gymnasia were designed not as places where people go to talk or to think, but places where people go to become strong through physical practice, through running, jumping, climbing, lifting, wrestling, and preparing to be the type of people who could fight in a shield wall as Greek hoplites. And it's there that Western philosophy was born. And it's there that these wisdom traditions started. And it's only later that we separate philosophy from these physical traditions. And that's not unique to the West either. Many of you guys may be familiar with Tai Chi. What you may not know is that Tai Chi is a specifically Taoist art, and that it is part of a whole ecology of wisdom practices that include meditation, physical alchemy, and all sorts of other things. Over here, we see sumo. Sumo is a specifically Shinto practice, and right? It's part of the wisdom practices of Shinto. At the bottom, you're all familiar with yoga, and yoga in the West has been sort of, it's been sort of moved into the body as object, as a way of experiencing it. But yoga, the original meaning of yoga has nothing to do with the asanas. It's one of the seven branches of Vedanta, which is, you know, the religion that we more commonly refer to as Hinduism. And it is, again, part of a very complete set of wisdom traditions. And over here we see Native American dance. And in shamanic traditions worldwide, we see that religious practice and insight generation is connected to tons of different physical practices, whether it's dancing, spinning, wrestling. We see this relationship between wisdom and the body is respected worldwide and historically in a way that we have lost access to. So we need to look at our relationship to the body. And one of the lenses that I really like here is this idea of reciprocal narrowing versus reciprocal opening or reciprocal widening. And this is the idea, again, that I get from John Vervaeke and influenced by his colleague, Mark Lewis. So Mark Lewis works in addiction, and he developed a different model of addiction. Rather than addiction simply being a chemical dependency, what addiction is a pattern of behavior that's learned over time, because someone comes to use a substance in a way that erodes the very thing they're using the substance to support them on. So if I am, say, experiencing anxiety and I use alcohol, then I dim my anxiety for a second, but I decrease my confidence in my ability to solve things, which then drives my anxiety up again. And so now I feel the need for alcohol. And same thing with many other drugs we can use this way. And so over time, I become more and more dependent on this substance to regulate my emotional state until it's the only thing that matters, until the only thing that I can be is an addict, and the only thing that matters to me is my relationship to that substance. That's the relationship of reciprocal narrowing. And when Verveke was exposed to this idea, he said, well, the opposite has to be true too. If there's reciprocal narrowing, there's also reciprocal widening. And that's precisely what I'm describing in my experience of parkour and in any other movement practice. You're widening the ways that you can relate to the world. You are getting new insight into how you can move, how you can experience the world, how you can relate to the world. In fact, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the most widely supported scientifically therapy modality, is basically about exposure therapy. And what are we engaging in when we do a physical practice? We're engaging in types of exposure therapy. I'm exposing myself to greater heights, to bigger jumps, to more intense physical interactions, right? To different types of physical interactions. And I'm growing my capacity as a person, right? I'm growing my capacity as a person. I'm growing my capacity to deal with these things. And there's a beautiful idea here. This isn't just what we're experiencing when we engage with a movement practice. This is also how we experience falling in love. Falling in love is a process of becoming more and more rapidly aware of our lover, and also of growing in competence together. So we are widening our capacity, widening how we understand each other, and we're falling in love. And what I'm suggesting is that if we can fall in love with the world more, that's going to be an incredibly powerful way for us to look at physical practice. So this also is reflected in Jordan Peterson's work, where he draws a kind of dichotomy between the hero's journey or the heroic archetype and how you operate within the heroic archetype and agoraphobia, right? Agoraphobia is another example of a reciprocal narrowing process, right? Someone feels anxiety about, say, being in the supermarket, so they stop going to the supermarket. They're regulating their behavior, they're narrowing themselves in order to prevent anxiety. They're now using this behavioral pattern. And then maybe being in parking lots starts to be scary, so they avoid parking lots. And then more and more places in the world become scary to them. Agora is a Greek word that means the market, right? It's fear of the market, fear of being outside of what's comfortable. And over time, you narrow yourself down and down and down. And the idea of the fundamental heroic archetype, according to Peterson, is the person who proactively confronts anomaly, who proactively confronts the chaos of being. So we can see again that we have this relationship of reciprocal widening and reciprocal narrowing. And here I think it's important to summarize the key idea of Peterson's model, because we need this. There's so much profundity in how we can find meaning in life when we can see this. Because the truth is, we live in a world of uncertainty whose complexity vastly exceeds our capacity to understand. We are subject to pain, illness, and injury. And worse, we are potentially both the victim and perpetrator of malevolence. In order to thrive and survive in such a world, we have to have a central orientation. And the most effective orientation we can adopt is one that accepts the suffering and uncertainty of our existence and proactively confronts the chaos of being in order to bring forth what is good from it. The truth is that our cognition, our consciousness, our sense of meaning are all continuous with our physiology, all a product of our evolution, and all of those atrophy when we do not exercise our capacities. So whether it is addiction, agoraphobia, or physical atrophy, we need to proactively pursue growth just to maintain ourselves, let alone to actually continue to develop. And it is within development that we can gird ourselves against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And when we adopt the right practices, the meaning in our world can grow, and we can look upon the world and see that it is good. So the optimal practice for me is one that leads us into a greater love of being, a greater desire to bring forth the good. And there are many, many layers to this. And again, movement isn't the only aspect of this. But once again, what I'm going to say is that movement is the piece that most fundamentally unites all the aspects of ourself. It's the root source of where meaning is found. And it's the best foundation that we can have for building a more meaningful life. So, movement is an answer to the meaning crisis. Meaning sustains a movement practice, and movement is a powerful tool for self-development. If you guys want to understand a little bit more about how we look at movement and what are the types of movements that best nourish us as human beings, I'll be addressing that tomorrow on the Movement and Anatomy channel. So check that out. And if you would like to get a taste of Evolve Move Play and what we do, we have a special package offer right now. You can use that, the URL down below. You get a bunch of free resources and you get a chance to join our foundations program and potentially our academy. So that is what I have for you guys today. So I rushed through that a little bit fast because I could not see the time. So we got plenty of time for questions.
All right, so if you have a question for those who are in the panel, please simply wave because you can't put it in the question and answer box. For everyone else, please put your question in the question and answer box. There you can actually vote on the question and we can pick the ones which are most relevant for everyone. Oh, Susan Bauer is here. Susan Bauer is one of our presenters. Highly appreciate. Screening a little bit through the.
So I'll address this, Miriam. Hi, Miriam. Good to see you. She says, I somehow like jumping and challenging the self rather than fighting and challenging others better. I think these are all important aspects of it, right? That's the distinction from, in some ways between evolved move play and parkour. And in many ways, that's a kind of like a return to the origins of parkour because most of the guys who started parkour were also martial artists. And that was part of the ways that they challenged themselves was in the martial arts that they performed together. I do think that there's something fundamental about locomotive play, right? Being able to move in the world. And the way that we can move in the way that you move yourself through the world is fundamental to everything else that you'd want to do. Because when you move something else, you're also moving yourself. When you do martial arts, you're also moving yourself. And the cool thing about flow sports, and this is something Stephen Kotler pointed out, is that you get to perfectly dial your flow knob. When you and I are competing, then my job is to prevent you from getting into flow and your job is to prevent me from getting into flow. But when it's just me versus the environment and I'm a good practitioner, I can very easily sort of tune the level of the challenge such that I have optimal access to the flow state and can spend more time in the flow state. And that time in the flow state is associated with much more rapid learning. And so having something like parkour as a fundamental practice that allows you to be in that flow state all the time, builds your capacity to recognize it and enter it in other situations. Whereas if you start with like a hard sparring, intense martial art, that can be very challenging to actually build the capacities necessary to gain the most insight out of your physical practice. I really love that stuff. I love kicking people in the head and getting hit. And I think it's really important. I think, you know, there's a reason why almost all the philosophers were wrestlers. Right? Philosophy, you know, Seneca, I think, Epictetus, who's the founder of Stoicism, talks very specifically about how you should look at philosophy as having the mindset of a wrestler. But I do think that there's some better ways to get there. And you can go check out my talk on the movement, on the Martial and Healing Arts channel to get a better insight into how we can give people a better access to the flow state and a much better learning environment for understanding play. So I see there's 5 questions. Do you want to feed them to me, Daniela?
I'm just inviting people also to like questions, so that gives a little bit more of an order. And I'm starting with a question from Lando. You have mentioned a few times your mentor, John Vervaeke. How important do you think it is to have a real life mentor, or do you think online is okay, like YouTube or something like that?
So I've never met John in person. I hadn't watched all of his series before I started talking to him in person, because I made the mistake of waiting too long to try to contact Jordan Peterson, and then he had blown up to a level of fame that made him unapproachable. So as soon as I John's the guy, I was like, I'm reaching out and getting him on my podcast. And then it turned out that he's become a huge supporter of my work, and I've just had an amazing relationship with him. But I've actually had a really difficult time with mentors through my life. I've had a lot of mentor relationships that have gone wrong. So this is kind of new for me to have some really wonderful mentors in my life who I have access to and can kind of just touch base with whenever I need it. So I can say that, yeah, I much prefer this. I much prefer having good and trustworthy and very supportive mentors and having the access to them, rather than just relying on their thoughts. Right? My relationship with John transforms me in different ways than my relationship with Jordan Peterson's work, because it's not just the ideas that I'm experiencing, it's actually the man and how he acts and how he is in conversation. And so it's not just his ideas, it's his carriage. And he is a kind of archetype for me to follow and how to be a sage and a good man in dialogue.
Beautiful. There's a question which a couple of people want to be answered. Can you maybe suggest movement practices people can do in lockdown, like a practice which helps people to feel empowered?
Mm-hmm. So I think, ideally I want everyone out in nature moving around, right? And but if you're stuck in your house, there's still lots of things that you can do. I have a video about how to do natural movement in your house, which is available on YouTube. We also had some great stuff at this conference that you can that you have access to. So Mike Fitch did a wonderful ground flow section on his basic animal flow model. I've actually been really physically inactive preparing for this. I had some other professional engagements that were taking a lot of my time plus this, and the combination just took me out of my practice more than anything has since I was 15 years old, which was not so much fun, but that was reality. And just being able to do Mike's session felt so good on my body. And then Ryan Hurst's session as well. Those are both things that you can do anywhere. And then of course the Foundations program that I mentioned is based on the idea of what can you do in the middle of the winter. So it's ground flow stuff, it's body integrity stuff, it's doing basic walks and scouting and getting to learn the nature around you. And doing basic mindfulness practices. So it's a lot of really wonderful stuff that you can use right now.
Yeah, and a question which comes with that from Emily, do you have also any tips for urban teens?
For what's that?
Urban teens. So kids living in urban environment.
Urban teens. Sorry, yes. Well, parkour, so interesting thing about parkour is that it starts in a group of kids who actually were in between a natural environment and a urban environment. So parkour is in many ways a way of reimagining urban spaces as providing opportunities for physical play in the way that children have always played in nature, right? So you give most kids access to a rocky creek bed or some really interesting trees, and they'll climb on them immediately, start jumping and running. And lots of adults and young adults will do that too, actually. But people had more of an inhibition about using urban spaces that way. And so parkour was this kind of radical reimagining of the urban spaces available for play. But the kids who started it were going back and forth between nature and between the urban environment. I would suggest, you can also find lots of nature in the city. Like, people don't realize there are trees that you can climb, lining many city blocks. There are parks. So I prefer being in nature, and I think that it's really important to connect to nature. But there's nothing wrong with using a handrail instead of a tree branch as a way of practicing manipulating yourself through the environment. There's nothing wrong with using a wall. Those are wonderful opportunities. And so the way that we build our programs actually is intentionally built such that you can find indoor environments to do it if possible. You can find it in urban environments and you can find it in nature, and we help you find those things.
Nice. A question which comes from Pear, which I personally find pretty interesting. Pear is asking, if movement sets the contextual basis for meaning, ontological expansion would seem to be a natural response. Why do you think this has shifted in American society so dramatically, other than or technological sophistication?
So it's quite a complex question, right? So movement sets the foundation, and then ontologically, like the knowledge of being is expanded when we engage with it. And then why have we lost that? Well, I think that checking out John Vervaeke's series, Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, is probably the best way to get a really deep dive into that, because he really covers the whole history of how we've ended up here, starting with the Axial Revolution and shamanism, and then the Axial Revolution and the rise of kind of the major religions that we have, and then going into the rise of philosophy. And then through, you know, Descartes and Kant and Bacon and all those figures. And so there's an interesting point at which the natural world is separated from the divine world, which happens with Thomas Aquinas. And that separation starts to make us look at the world that we experience as somehow profane and something that you want to disconnect from. And this is a pretty late development, really, in Christianity in, say, the 13th century. But we started to sort of disembody ourselves at that point in history. That's much more his field, and I think that he describes it better than I can. But I'll just leave it at he's got the best explanation of that you can find.
So this is certainly a topic to dive a little bit more deeper in with John Vervaeke.
Yeah.
So Christine is asking, what does atrophic represent in the hero's journey?
Atrophic.
Atrophic, yeah. That's what you write.
Like atrophy? Can I see that?
Yeah, atrophy.
So atrophy is sort of the opposite of the hero's journey, right? Because the hero's journey is being challenged and going out to the challenge, right? And that's how all of the aspects of the self grow, right? So, you know, you can think of it as a muscle. A muscle grows when it's stressed, right? You introduce a challenge to the muscle changes over time, it rests, it recovers, it comes back better. That's basically, like, you can see that it's like a little mini hero's journey. So what happens when you deny the call? You fall apart. And this is another thing that I love about what Peterson points out, is that generally that challenges deferred become bigger. There's a beautiful book. What is the name of this book? I wish I could remember it. I have it on the shelf, but it's There's No Such Thing as Dragons. It's a little book for kids. And in the book, this little boy, Billy Bixby, wakes up one day and there's a dragon in his room. And it's the size of a kitten. And he pats it on the head and it purrs. And then he goes downstairs and tells his mom that he's seen a dragon. And she says, there's no such thing as dragons. And as soon as she denies that there's a dragon there, it starts growing. And then it eats all of his food. And then it grows so big that it runs away with his house. And his dad comes home from work and has to, like, find his house somewhere else in the neighborhood. And he goes and says, you know, what happened here? And the mom says, you know, he says, Billy starts to say, the dragon did it. And the mom says, there's no such thing as dragons. He's like, there is such a thing as a dragon. And they acknowledge the dragon, he pats it on the head, and as soon as he pats it on the head, it starts to decrease in size again. And so the basic idea is that we go through life basically playing out scripts. We have a motivation, which creates a script. We fulfill the motivation, or something wrong happens, right? Now, stories that go from motivation to fulfillment with nothing happening in between are completely uninteresting, right? If someone started to tell you, like, oh, what's the most interesting thing that happened today? I was hungry, I ate a peanut butter sandwich. You'd be like, you're the boringest person, right? So it's when an anomaly happens. I went to get peanut butter out of the fridge and I realized that my roommate had eaten all of the peanut butter. And, you know, that's not part of our arrangement. He shouldn't be eating my food. So I had to go have a confrontation with my roommate. Okay, now we have an interesting story. There's an anomaly, okay? So now there's two ways that you deal with this. One is you go confront the roommate. The other is you ignore it. And now the roommate eats the next thing and the next thing. Now you don't have any food. And now the dragon of your relationship with your roommate has grown bigger and bigger. Right? You get a note from the IRS. Ignore it today. It's going to be a worse note the next time that you see it. Or maybe you're in a relationship and your partner says to you, you know, we need to have a conversation. You say, well, I can't right now. And then the next time they say, I can't right now, I can't right now, I can't right now. Do you think that conversation is going to be easier to handle a month of deferment later, or if you handle it the moment that it comes up? So every aspect of the self grows when it's confronted with challenge. But when challenges are not confronted, they grow. And when the challenges grow, then we have the potential for a catastrophe. So, yeah. Next question.
Yeah, people reflect on this in the chat. So would like to, they love the dragon analogy.
Pick up the book. It's for kids, but it's great.
Sarah is asking, I'm not sure if it's completely serious, the question, but I want to read it anyway because I like it. It's, how would you explain to a nihilist that their atrophy is actually malevolent?
How would you explain to a nihilist that their atrophy is actually malevolent? That's a good question. I don't know the answer, right? I mean, I think that the first thing you have to establish is actually that nobody doesn't believe in anything, right? You can claim to not believe in anything, but it's not true, right? So, the very simplest and perhaps most brutal way to do this would be slap them in the face. Say, you know, is that, do you believe in the pain? Because if you believe in the pain, then you have a value system, right? Most likely you would value not experiencing that pain right now. Maybe you value the pain, but either way, there's something about your experience that you want to be different. I'm a martial artist and a cruel, angry person. So I think of slapping somebody, but you could introduce anything else, right? You'd be like, hey, do you want this piece of chocolate? And they'd be like, yeah, I want that piece of chocolate. I'd be like, no, you can't have it. Because in order to have a piece of chocolate, you have to admit that you value having the piece of chocolate. So once you have the conversation that actually there is some inherent value system that they implicitly have to accept, then you can start having the conversation of what might be a value system that actually will make their life better and the lives of people around them better. And I think that, that's ultimately what we need to be focused on.
That's a really, really nice answer to that. I need to chuckle here. So before we kind of wrap up, I would like to ask one last question, which came up is, which kind of touches base on this, but it's a little bit more simple. If somebody doesn't want to move, like everyone here in the call, or most people are very passionate about movement, but this is not the normal thing. So there are people out there sitting on the couch and are they, how do you get somebody to move? How do you get somebody to develop at least some passion for movement? It's a question which came from Lando as well.
I think it depends on how atrophied they are, how uncomfortable in their body they are. There's a lot of people who will enjoy movement if you trick them into doing it, right? Like take someone to the water slides, right? That's movement. You've been moving, you move all day, you're having a good time. And then just sort of start inviting them to more things that are like that, that have some kind of movement component that is enjoyable. And then you can start kind of hinting at what this is all about. For someone who's severely atrophied, severely overweight, any physical activity can be painful. And unfortunately, they generally have to have a crisis to recognize that how they're living is not sustainable. But once they have that crisis, if you're ready to support them, often they're really ready to rebound because they've seen how horrible it is to be trapped in their body. And they've already experienced a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And so a lot of times the pain and suffering of moving once they decide to do it is actually pretty easy to go through. So I've met lots of these people through my years of being in the industry, and you'll see these people who hit that rock bottom, and they will become the most passionate, the most powerful, the greatest advocates of physical practice that you'll find.